With Professor Thurman's paper, we move to another both physical and historical dimension of our topic. Professor Thurman began as a student of classical languages. He did his work at Texas, and much of his published work has been on Justinian's Code. He's worked especially on the Code and the novels in the Corpus Juris Civilis. His interest in Civitas, he says, is a personal one. Of course, it comes also from his work in classical languages. His title today is not going precisely to be Michael Servetus as Hellenist, though we'll talk about that, but more generally, how Servetus used the Bible. Professor Thurman.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. I'll try to cut some of this and see whether we can preserve a little time for discussion. We shall prepare to consider specific examples of how Servetus used the Bible by taking note of two characteristics of Servetus' polemics. One is his tendency to formulate his doctrinal position in the light of the impression that Christianity ought to make on outsiders to the faith. He held that the Trinitarian theory offered an insuperable obstacle to the universal acceptance of Christianity. What Turk, he asked, what Turk, Scythian, or barbarian can bear without making fun of them those metaphysical disputes of yours, which Paul calls arguments over words? He held that Trinitarian theory provided Rabbi David Kimkai with too much ammunition against Christians, and also that the Christians had themselves given occasion to Muhammad of denying that Christ is God. The second characteristic of his polemics is the anticipation of the rebuttal of his opponents. In the manner of a cautious debater, he regards his case as less pregnable if he himself can explain in advance what the position of his adversary will be. If he can deprive him of his fire by letting his audience know that he is aware of what arguments his opponent will use, he feels far more secure. In modern America, Servetus would no doubt be discredited as a product of the Bible Belt. He expressed his passion for the Scriptures as follows: I beg you, read the Scriptures 1,000 times, for if you do not develop a taste for them by reading them, it is because you have lost the key of knowledge, even the Christ. You will recover the key by knocking relentlessly. There are a number of other quotations like this that I'll skip. But among them, he says, I discover all philosophy and wisdom in the Bible. This will have significance later in my presentation. Because so many scholastic distinctions regarding the Trinity seem to him to have sprung from Greek philosophy rather than the Bible, Servetus continually emphasized that the original converts to the Christ were women and uncouth persons of the lower classes. Metaphysical sophists had polluted the pure stream of Christianity and had played havoc with the word that was given to butchers, bakers, and candlestick makers. He doesn't use those words, but those are analogous. For now I wish, he says, in utter simplicity, that little old women, dim-sighted men, and barbers might acknowledge that Christ is the Son of God. Christ did not converse with philosophers, but with the people, who included these little children and women. This approach may not seem very profound until one considers that his primary objective is to reconstruct the circumstances of the delivery of the ancient message of the disciples and apostles, in order that its meaning to the ancients might be restored. Therefore, as he disparages the intrusion of metaphysical subtleties as an unhealthy exegesis, he also expounds the modern exegetical doctrine of interpretation with a view to the general cultural context and the specific milieu of the language involved. Then I have a section here in which I discuss his law studies and how that his ideas of interpretation may have come largely from the treatment given to the Roman law in France. You're familiar with the distinction between the mos italicus and the mos gallicus of legal interpretation. In Italy, the lawyers were very traditional and very literal in their approach to the law. In France, great attention was paid to the circumstances under which the law was promulgated and to what effect this would have upon the sense of the law, the purport of the law. Nevertheless, we may cite many passages in the Hebrew scriptures especially, where Servetus discovers far-fetched allegorical meanings. The evil beasts, for example, who inhabit deserted Babylon are individually identified according to species and habits with various ranks and orders of the Roman clergy. In this, he fully exercises his ingenuity in the interpretation of Hebrew nouns. Had he himself considered whether Isaiah's audience might have received such visions of clerical grandeur from what their prophet was saying, he might have suffered a more propitious fate. Sebastian Castello, for example, was only exiled from Geneva, not burned at the stake, because he had literalized the Song of Songs. I find him more inclined to indulge in the interpretation of Scripture by Scripture than to resort to the original. In most passages where he displays his talent in the ancient tongues, he is arguing from the etymology or the peculiar sense of a word or short expression. We shall examine a few examples of these as he deals with the creation theme. The word rakiyah in the creation account ought to be translated not firmamentum, as though it were unscientifically solid or hard, but as expansio and extensio. Furthermore, the dual number in which the word heavens sometimes occurs shows that there were two created heavens, one of air and one of water. Therefore, he says, when Paul spoke of going to the third heaven, he must have had reference to an uncreated heaven, namely the habitation of God. The plural used in the expression breath of lives, nishmat hayim, also bears upon natural philosophy. For it implies, he says, the three kinds of life, vegetable, sensitive, and intellectual, the world of plants, animals, and men. Moreover, he also displayed his skill in his solution of difficult passages within a larger context. His handling of the statement regarding the scepter and Judah in Genesis 49:10 provides a typical case. He appeals to the difference between the Hebrew notations Achnach and Zakef, and finds also a linguistic analogy in the use of Shiloh in Joshua 18:1. He then interprets this passage to mean, the scepter shall not depart from Judah, nor a lawgiver from between his feet. Up to that time, however, the assembly of the people shall come, even to him, to Shiloh. And I might note that I haven't examined all the interpretations available in the Reformation period of Genesis 49:10, but this view seems to be far in advance of his day. Servetus had become so familiar with Greek that his use of it in the text of his works does not obtrude itself on the reader. He had become well-versed with a wide variety of authors, representing a broad chronological spectrum and also a broad dialectal spectrum. His repertoire of Greek scholarship ranges from Hesiod and Aristophanes to the Neoplatonists and Petrology. He knew the Hippocratic corpus, and perhaps no man of his day knew Galen better, the Greek text of Galen. His notes to the text of the geography of Claudius Ptolemy, edited by Pyrchimerus and published in 1535, reveal unusual critical acumen. This also has to do with geographic knowledge shown. He was deeply imbued with Plato, with Aristotle, and Philo Judaeus in the original. He identifies the mind of God with the Platonic homeland of ideal forms, the chorai zeon. The Hebrew word good, tov, applied to the world in the creation. He identifies with the ideal of moral perfection called kalokagathia in Plato. He identifies the entelechy of Aristotle with the light, which is the light of man, and the spermatikos technikos of Philo with the word of God. He knew Aratus, Seneca, Plutarch, Macrobius, Iamblichus, Porphyry, Proclus, and many others. His favorite source, however, was Trismegistus, which we now know as the Hermetic Corpus, a collection of the 3rd century A.D. which seeks to combine Neoplatonism and Philonic Judaism. Among these works, he most often cites the Poimander, or De Potestate Sapientia Divina. The Editio Princeps, by the way, of this work did not appear until 1554, the year following his execution. Among the church fathers, he cites the apostolic fathers, Irenaeus, Origen, Clement of Alexandria, Eusebius of Caesarea, Epiphanius, Cyril, Cyprian, Basil the Great, and John of Damascus on the Greek side, Hilarius, Tertullian, Ambrose, Augustine, and Isidore on the Latin side. He knew the Apocrypha in Greek and had read copiously from the Targums and the Talmud. His intimate acquaintance with Greek attracts the notice of anyone who will make a cursory examination of his Latin text. He sprinkles it with words like apostasia, varathros, I might as well stick to the modern Greek since I started with that, demonis stigmata, hypostasis, logos, tartarus, and so on, as if he infected those rude and uncouth fishermen who would read his book to understand all this. Here again, as when he dealt with the Hebrew text, his use of the original ranges from the consideration of individual words to the interpretation of problem passages. As for the former, the following serve as examples. Apophgasma means Re Lucentia or Fulgor Divinus. Aparte must indicate not simply now, but a modo, post hoc, de inceps, ex hoc tempore, where Jesus said to the high priest, from now you shall see the Son of Man seated on the right hand of power and coming on the clouds of heaven. Apolitrosis proves stronger than mere litrosis and thus denotes perfecta et consummata redemptio. Even his etymology sometimes passed modern standards, for he links the Latin anima, or soul, with the Greek animos, wind. As for the latter, we refer the reader to Philippians 2. I mean by the latter the broader category of dealing with the more extensive passage. I won't go into all the ins and outs of Philippians 2. You know the problem of kenosis there. In the interpretation of which, Servetus does not seem to be as determined to express theological bias as the King James translators. Moreover, says Servetus, it would have been forcible seizure, rapina, if the Christ had appropriated to himself the regal domination of this world. He finds the Trinitarian use of these verses for theological ends deplorable, and argued that the word Esau should be understood adverbially, so that the passage would indicate a human attitude, hominis dispositio, not those metaphysical, incorporeal, and equal natures. Then I refer to something rather famous, but I'm going to perhaps shed light for one or two here on an aspect of it not commonly referred to. He drew from the scripture, as well as from anatomy, his theory of the pulmonary circulation of the blood, for which Sir William Harvey later furnished more complete physiological evidence. God, with his spirit, which vivifies like a spark, scintilla, inspired the soul of Adam, not only from such episodes as the reanimation of the dry bones by Ezekiel, but also from Aristotle's Peripsychis, his treatise on the soul. Servetus connects the soul with the flow of air in and out of the body, aereus flatus, he calls it. He appeals to the etymology of the Hebrew word soul, nephesh, as follows. Therefore, soul in Hebrew has the force of spiratio. He found, however, explicit statements in the Hebrew text of the Pentateuch, locating the principal seat of the soul not in the walls of the heart, not in the trunk of the brain, nor in the liver, but in the blood. Sed in sanguine ut docet ipse deus, he says, and then cites Genesis 9, Leviticus 17, Deuteronomy 12. Accompanied by erudite excursus embracing the classical history of medical theory, we find his unmistakable conclusion. that lighter hue, eleflavus color, is imparted to the vitalized blood, sanguis spirituosus, by the lungs, not by the heart. Furthermore, as the successor to Vesalius, who had served as the preceptor to Professor Günther, he provided compelling anatomical evidence for his view. Of course, this is the one passage in the Christianisme Restitutio. If you haven't seen a reprint of it, I have one here on the desk. This is the one passage in that work that has been dealt with over and over many times by medical historians. As the title of Servetus's work, Christianisme Restitutio, implies, Thomas and Alexander Camel were by no means the first to advocate a restoration of the ancient order of things. Servetus conceived the function of his magnum opus as the summoning of the whole apostolic church back to her own threshold and a complete restoration of the knowledge of God, of faith in Christ, of our justification, of the regeneration of baptism, and of the partaking or sharing in the Lord's meal or Lord's supper. The phraseology in which Servetus expressed his concept of restoration strongly resembles that found in the restoration movement of the Camels. Alexander Camel expressed his objectives like this: to bring the societies of Christians up to the New Testament is to restore the ancient order of things. To both men, the woman of Revelation 12, whom the dragon chases into the wilderness, where she remains 1260 days, symbolized that the papacy would persecute the true church into obscurity for 1260 years. But whereas the Camels chose Phocas, a later emperor, as a terminus a quo, Servetus had chosen Constantine, an earlier emperor. So to make the time work out right, the scheme matches in each case. It may interest you to know that one of the sources of this bit of information is the Christianisme Restitutio, page 666 has this.
Yeah.
Even the theory that the kingdom of heaven finds its fulfillment in the Church of Christ of the present age was expounded by Servetus, and in many of the same terms that Camel uses, using identical proof texts. In the works of these two reformers, separated by centuries, we can cite amazing analogies in the development of their doctrinal thought. Indeed, most of the points that drove the rift wider between the Camel affiliates and other contemporary Protestants turn out to be identical to the most violent points of disagreement between Servetus and Calvin. Contrary to popular opinion, the question of Godhead seems to have constituted a comparatively minor aspect of the Servetus-Calvin controversy. Only a couple of the first letters in the correspondence deal with that, and the argument there is not really very heated. Incidentally, on the question of Godhead, Alexander Camel, too, at first refused to be drawn into controversy, but he later took a stand. E.M. Wilbur, the translator of Servetus' 1531 publications on the Trinity, well observed that Servetus' intention was not so much to deny the doctrine of the Trinity as to call attention to the errors in the doctrine as it was commonly held. My own opinion is that if we may regard Servetus as a precursor of Unitarianism in any sense, it is not because he formulated any specific Unitarian theory, but because his intellectual curiosity entitles him to such a place. The most keenly provocative issues between Calvin and Servetus were whether the sovereignty of God precludes freedom of the human will, whether justifying faith exists altogether within the heart, and this has to do with the same theme that you took up from Erasmus' paraphrase on Romans, whether justifying faith exists altogether within the heart or must be accomplished by external works, as when Abraham was justified by works in offering up Isaac. And thirdly, the relationship between the law and the gospel. On this last question, the law and the gospel, of course, the point comes up about the dichotomy into moral law and ceremonial law. And many of the same arguments passed between Calvin and Servetus on this. Calvin saying that not the ceremonial, but only the moral law is binding. Servetus saying that the moral law was done away with in the Ten Commandments sense just as surely as the ceremonial. And the same points are made in that controversy that you can now read in almost any of the debates between the Christian Church and Church of Christ people and the Seventh-day Adventists on that very question, point by point. You can find nearly all the scriptures referred to. On each of these three matters, the founder of the Restoration Movement stood just where the author of the Christianisme Restitutio had stood. The human will is free, faith without works is dead, and Christians are not under either the Ten Commandments or the ceremonies of the law. Furthermore, certain corollaries of these issues logically fell into focus, and as surprising as it may seem, regarding each one, Camel later stood precisely where Servetus had stood. Point one, baptism confers remission of sins and forms the line of demarcation between the church and the world. And here, both men, incidentally, use as an illustration of their belief Naaman's cleansing from leprosy in 2 Kings 5. That would be Fourth Kingdoms, wouldn't it, if we use the old system. Infants need not and must not be baptized. And thirdly, the regenerated Christian may so fall from grace as to be eternally lost. Like Camel, Servetus went a step beyond Luther in asserting not only the priesthood, but also the ministry of all true believers. Both men identified Rome and her predecessor Babylon as the polluted and meretricious source of clerical domination. Servetus rehearses parallels between ancient pagan cults and the Roman Catholic viewpoint that would be worthy of Alexander Hislop's book, Two Babylons. On the other hand, we cannot know how justified Servetus might have been. I had a page out of order. Although the exegetical reasoning of Servetus may be worthy of consideration, the enthusiasm with which he urges his views betrays him into the use of expressions and epithets that give grave and needless offense. He calls his opponents on the Godhead not only Trinitarii, but Troetai, a much less welcome term, and even atheists. They conceive their arguments through sophisms, and their logic must lead them to confess that their God is an ass. His opponents are wretchedly deceived by hallucinations. He likens Calvin to his face, to a contriver of arguments out of words at will, a pleaser of himself with delusions, one unable to discriminate among Gentile, Jew, or Christian, a dreamer along with his Luther, greatly ignorant, he says, magna est tua ignorantia, a carnal person, a victim of diabolical bewitchment, and a Muhammad or some false Jew, Shuzo Uzziah. On the other hand, we cannot know how justified Servetus might have been in complaining to Calvin, Convitiis me obruis, you drown me in vituperation. As it turned out, Calvin, to his shame, saw to it that Servetus was overwhelmed with more than invective.
We have a little over 20 minutes before our business meeting begins. I wonder if we could use it for some kind of reaction to these three very interesting papers.
All the rest, and here is the interpretation of original sin. truth becomes its existential character, and those lingering thoughts did not move on in this direction. Conrad Grebel and others in this group around Zwingli certainly did. And furthermore, Luther was quite aware of this difference with Zwingli. He didn't want him to live behind him. And there's an old Lutheran quote that goes something like this. There's Zwingli thinks that feel ears and wings and powers of oxygen things to him he didn't know. And it's decided this point. And Erasmus and Zwingli were also aware of the fact, you know, not merely that Augustine got into this as a result of the conflict with Blazing, but that he was careless with the text, using an old Latin text for Romans 5:12, where it says, in quote, instead of in quote, in whom all men sin. And of course, the Romans voted for that correctly, in quote, but Augustine wasn't using that. And it got that in having called things to law. And of course, I'm in person.
The translation in 1540 is of the paraphrase, as you know.
Now, let's comment a little bit on the second page, too, and react to it. I'm sorry, Mr. Sumter, you're an expert on, German.
May I just interrupt you a second on the Erasmus on infant? This does precisely, of course, connect up with Erasmus on infant baptism, to which he always was rather cool, except that, of course, he could not reject it on the basis of the authority of the Church. But his arguments in favor of it are very, very tenuous, and he has considerable appreciation for the anti-Baptist position, actually.
I may have misunderstood the fact that it is very small, but I thought I heard it. Another thing to look into, and I haven't, would be Samuel Rutherford's letters.
and the part that the prophet did not, were unique.
Well, I think that that spiritual tradition is expressed only metaphoric.
I think that was a completely traditional view of it, both the Middle Ages and the fall of the
Well, you identified by making a kind of distinction between history-oriented and history-oriented, which would lead you to apply to a rational.
Well,
I wonder if you really support that. The oriented toward history is not to exclude nature.
No, in fact, you know, in a way, I think there is kind of almost a sort of emphasis and contradiction in my paper, possibly, because in the beginning, what I'm really trying to emphasize is the fact of continuity. On the other hand, and in which case I do think that essentially medieval and expressed Reformation attitude towards symbolism in the place of metaphor really are very much more alike than they are different. Although then, looking at the practice, it seems to me that in certain areas, and namely in this image of the nuptial image, it's very central, that the central to the whole idea of the mystical body in terms of that when it comes to practice, on the way that image is handled, it seems to me that there's a tension. And more of a tension, possibly because there are people who are married and have a different existential experience, but that there seems to be more of a tension about accepting sex as a sacramental kind of symbol. And so it seems to me, I don't know how it would explain it, but it seems to me that they do refer to a didactic interpretation of the natural limits. And this is a difference that I think any examination of the text that their interpretation of the nuptial limit is always in terms of the domestic hierarchical relation of husband and wife. And it seems to me this is not true of at least one very large tradition in the medieval and Renaissance Catholic interpretation. But I don't really want to go beyond that, just the old generalizations that Protestants are anti-symbolic and anti-sacramental, although I suppose the sacrifice has goes with that.
If I may just remind the audience what Mr. Strucker said last year, there's some very interesting convergences in what you say and ways in which your talk might suggest further lines for Mr. Strucker to examine. He, of course, told us that in Protestant marriage manuals, the relationship between Christ and the church was the image that was always used to guide the marriage. He did suggest that what was primarily talked about in the marriage were moral virtues, and in the how to do it sex part, there was always considerable constraint in discussing sex. Not that it was thought of as negative, but you weren't supposed to become all decorum, was not to be overcome. There was always to be a restraint on both sides. You weren't supposed to like it too much, but you always to think about the other person and respect him. And this acted as a constraint on the kind of abandonment you described from Bernard. The only problem is that those of us who worked in the medieval sex manuals would find that Bernard, that Schnucker's stuff about the Puritans, sounds more like the medieval manuals, which also recommend restraint. And Bernard's expression may indeed be that of a non-married man rather than someone who's counseling the marriage. So this suggests problems both for him and for you.
I think one of the differences that come up in this kind of thing is often the difference between the kind of material examined.
Yes.
And it seems to me, where I began differing originally with the people, the medievalists who I studied with, was that their interpretation of the medieval attitude toward marriage always came from a study of sermons and moralistic treatises, one kind of ethical tracts, and so on. And you get a completely different image when you look at the poetry or at mystical expression, devotional poetry. And it's possibly not so much a difference historically. Yes. There is just between,
yeah,
in any case,
the convention of
the
genre,
the moral, ethically oriented writer, and mm-hmm. the one who's oriented toward devotion.
Mm-hmm.
Like I was going to raise a question. In most of the literature that you draw on there for the medieval is the mystical, that is, mm-hmm. Bernard, mm-hmm. John the Cross, etc. Did you pay as much attention to the commentator, the scholastic commentator, as such, besides the commentator?
No, I think what I said there is that most of the medieval, or many of the medieval commentaries, are completely comparable in their attitude and in ignoring sex as such, as there is in the Protestant commentaries. What is different is that there is also this large strain in the medieval commentaries which you don't find except in the literature, except in Rufus's Everdale, except in the poetic and literary manifestations, which are always, I suppose, tend to be more traditional.
Okay.
think that's true. I think the like the glossal and area and the scholastic commentaries and themes and things like that are just, you know, as completely comparable to like Westminster Assembly. Very little difference between but the only thing that is different is that there's a whole other tradition, which is a very strong one, because the other commentators are always saying, these are the people who really have felt the pulse of the Song of Songs, and we can't hope to measure up to it. We don't even attempt what they're doing. So they always at least theoretically give a priority to people like ours and Gregory and Iceland, even though they don't try to do it themselves.
How much have you connected up to the Romantic Love tradition, 12th century, so forth?
That concept I don't even want to join with.
Throw that in.
There's a thing about what Courtly Love is satirical or, and Robertson is my advisor, and very strongly argue this whole tradition.
In connection with the point that we tried a minute ago, I get the impression that the Protestant sources that you have were primarily within the Reformed tradition.
Quickly talking about the Reformation.
You don't do work with Luther's materials sufficiently that you might be able to venture judgment as to whether there's a difference between the Lutheran and the
Calvinist
Swingling tradition
in this tradition. Well, I can say the commentaries I've looked at, which come from a variety of different sectarian books, I haven't been able to really see any kind of difference that I would mention any generalization about. I mean, the really striking difference are those people who are completely outside the mainstream, who act like Castellio, who actually deny the name. Or on the other hand, the Catholic Spanish interpretation of people like the Greek, which is totally different. But I haven't been able to find any significant generalizations instead of the Puritan, Lutheran, Calvinist, and all. To pull up any obvious category. There may be.
I think briefly, someone else could fill
You made one point about that he was the one who took the happy realm to be an image of the happy realm, sexual politics.
Well, in fact, Luther is one of the people who, and I would like to pursue this further, because when I said that the Boston interpretation of Ephesians, that the image in a good chapter of Ephesians is not one essentially applied on, whether it's equality and union of two in one flesh, that in fact, is perpetuated in Luther's. And in fact, Luther even written the commentary, he refers to the gospel. And this seems to go against completely the generalizations, all the ones that I've ever heard about the nuptial image and about marriage always being primarily envisioned in hierarchical terms. Because this seems to imply that there's a strange difference. And I've seen it at least in the commentary in Galatians.
I might add that the Rasmus, who probably was inspired it or something, he had his own view, his very distinct views, you know, on marriage, which had tremendous amount of influence. Of course, looked upon marriage as the union of flesh, and but spiritualized, the consensus of the soul, vis-a-vis the medieval contractual understanding of marriage. And that's the personal union of the two, is something which he very much emphasized over the medieval canonism.
I'd like to remark on that too. The point about Erasmus having a somewhat different view of things happening in the now, doesn't it seem first that whether or not you think this is important depends on your starting point? In other words, if you evaluate the changes that Erasmus made after 1527, for example, in understanding what Paul was like, from the standpoint of Luther's doctrine of faith, then your conclusion must be that the changes that are at stake are not too significant, because he retains, as you say, certainly his belief in free will. But if, on the other hand, you think that your starting point, your Erasmus' own position, at the time, for example, of the composition of the Enchiridion, when it's kind of the whole basis of his moral optimism, seems to be an identification between the Platonic notion of soul, article and just assume to be unpainted. I mean, if you paint this to be a kind of basic article for Red, it's humanist optimist. Then the repudiation of this at a later date takes on a bigger degree of significance.
So I think that's saying much too much. I think that he retains his humanist optimism up to the end, because I indicated one of the passages in the, and that's not the only one. You can also read passages in the Death Paparazzo on Morrison, which also talk about and talk in more optimistic terms. I don't think he gave that up. So I think the changes on flesh actually do not necessarily pertain to that particular problem. I think they may have been. I will deny a possibility of influence of Luther there, but something which I have not sufficiently investigated. It is his preoccupation with Chrysostom in the last day of 1520, and Chrysostom has a much less negative view and much less a dualistic view of flesh and spirit than does Origen, for example. Also, this is in keeping with his greater attention to the letter vis-a-vis allegory or the spirit in his work ever beginning with the Novus Testamentum in 1516. It also is in keeping with his views on the sacrament, where he gives a greater place to the flesh of the flesh of the sacrament than he had previously, for example, in the three. I think without doubt the ingredient has a greater emphasis upon the kind of dualism and the higher position of spirit of the flesh, then he comes his later writing, except in text, in a paraphrase on Romans, and even though he makes certain changes in the Ecclesiastes on understanding the flesh, flesh is being later on in Ecclesiastes, he does not make any changes in the paraphrase on Romans on that point. He makes other kinds of changes, but he doesn't change that at all. I think it's an unresolved tension in him.
Well, there's the one side that is what he understands by flesh inside the body, and there's the other side, namely that for a reason. And I sort of think Franklin after 1527, well, not to choose that one day so specifically, but in the latter part of his life, he's generally less optimistic about the moral possibilities of human nature, because it's tied into his soul. You can see a pessimism in certain kinds of ways.
Are there any comments before we close on further comments on Professor Thurman's paper?
One question. I appreciate very much the fact that you talked about the restoration aspect of this week's work misunderstood. In that connection, you mentioned 1260, and I was wondering whether you found at all in the whole tradition of corpus any reference to Joachim of Fiore as a radical consistent tradition that develops this idea.
I've just been informed by the president of our conference that the end is not our world, but our session has been declared. And to fulfill all prophecies, we must now draw our meeting to a close and thank our speakers for these very interesting papers.